officer, and make no mistake about it, my employer was extremely junior, does not, in the normal course of affairs, include diplomatic negotiations with the supreme rulers of alien planets. For the most part, a Legion captain is expected to avoid attracting the notice of anyone other than his immediate supervisors. As for any actual decision-making, that is best left to those qualified, which, in practice, usually means the sergeants nominally under his command. In this matter, as in many others, my employer had made himself the exception, as much by sheer luck as by any great personal initiative. Having been the first human to make contact with the Zenobians, he found himself invited to lead the first military expedition to the homeworld of that unusual race, and, more or less by default, once on Zenobia, he became the senior representative of the Alliance government. As a result, he was responsible for the negotiation of all kinds of business between off-worlders and the natives. As the astute listener will already have grasped, this had both its advantages, notably the possibility of putting himself in the position of primary beneficiary of any unusually lucrative business, and its disadvantages. After a number of months on the planet, my employer had just begun to realize just what some of the latter might be.
"That is impossible, Captain," said Chief Potentary Korg.
Fool couldn't read the Zenobian leader's face, but there wasn't much doubt about what his words meant. The translator's confidence level readout was sitting on 93%, plus or minus 5%. Between the languages of two races of Sophonts that had evolved on separate planets with no interspecies contact until the last couple of years, electronic translation didn't get any more confident than that. At least, the machine seemed to think so.
"The Legion doesn't like to use that word," said Fool, with a smile he hoped the Zenobian would read the same way a human would.
A display of teeth wasn't necessarily a friendly gesture, especially when dealing with a race of carnivorous dinosaur-like aliens, but so far he hadn't had any adverse reactions to the expression.
"The Legion's lexical preferences are not my affair," said Korg.
He showed his own teeth, which Fool knew was probably equivalent to a human smile. At least, when Flight Lieutenant Qual showed his teeth, it was a smile. So at least the Zenobian didn't seem to be personally offended by the request. It looked more as if his refusal was a policy matter that Fool could turn around by offering a few incentives. Fool had dealt with that kind of problem before.
"Of course, we wouldn't expect to bring a party of off-world hunters onto your planet without some compensation," he began.
"Compensation?" Korg blinked. "It is not a matter that can be orthogonalized by compensation, Captain. This is the sacred ancestral swampland of the Zenobian race that you propose I allow your off-world hunters to invade."
Fool held up his hands. "Chief Korg, I hope you don't think I'd come to you with such an unseemly proposal. In fact, we off-worlders are only here at your invitation. It would be very bad form for us to tell you to open up any particular areas of your beautiful planet for off-world visitors. But you were willing to open an area that your people weren't using for our Legion camp. Why not another area for off-world people to hunt in, for appropriate compensation, of course?" Korg stood and went to the window, staring out at the huge, asparagus-like trees that lined the street outside. After a moment, he turned to face the video pickup and said,
"I will take this under consideration. There may be areas we can allow your hunters to visit, as long as they remain within the bounds specified, and destroy only those species we permit. And at the same time, I shall determine what compensation ought to be appropriate. If your hunters are prosperous enough to come visit Zenobia simply to hunt, I would expect that they can sustain a significant disbursement for the privilege."
"That sounds like something we can agree on," said Fool. "Could you have some of your people give me a list of areas that might become available for hunting, and if possible, some indication of what kind of game would be available in those areas? Once I have that in hand, we can begin to find out how much our bigwigs might be willing to pay for the privilege of coming here to hunt."
"So let it be encoded," said Chief Potentary Korg. "So let it be done."
He closed the video connection. Fool turned to Beaker, who had sat just outside of the video pickup's field of view, monitoring the exchange.
"Well, Beaks, I think we've got what we're after, assuming the old lizard doesn't set too high a price for shooting his dinos.
Since State will be footing the bill, I suspect the price will be no object, sir," said Beaker. "They can simply have the IRS pass the cost along to the taxpayers. Business as usual, in other words."
"IRS," said Fool.
"Ugh, don't remind me.
If you hadn't found me a galaxy-sized loophole, Those bloodsuckers would have drained me dry. I'm amazed they gave up so easily.
Don't be so sure that they have, sir, said Beaker. Or, alternatively, that they haven't persuaded their friends in other government agencies to single you out for their attentions. It may be no coincidence that the Alliance Ecological Interplanetary Observation Union has chosen to request an environmental impact statement from you, not exactly the thing one would expect them to require of a military unit, if you follow me.
Oh, I doubt that's anything to worry about, said Fool.
He leaned back in his chair and propped his feet up on his desk.
Odds are it's just some bureaucrat looking for a way to pressure us into tossing him a bribe. I don't mind that, as long as the rascal stays properly bribed once I've paid him.
There's never any real guarantee of that, sir, said Beaker. The best one can hope for is that not too many other bureaucrats learn where the pot of gold is located, but sooner or later they're certain to sniff it out.
We'll worry about that if it happens, said Fool, and unless I get old and fat before my time, I'll have moved on to something else by the time they realize they might be able to get a few credits out of me. It's hard to pick a man's pockets when he won't stand still and wait for you.
I hope you're right, sir, said Beaker. One never ought to underestimate one's enemies, especially when they wield the power to tax and to imprison.
Oh, I won't underestimate them, old bean, said Fool, but I'm not about to let them scare me either.
Very well, sir, said Beaker,
but his expression made it clear that he had ample reservations.
Well, if you're trying to hide anything from me, you're doing a damn good job of it, said Victor Fool grudgingly.
The captain brought in some pretty slick accountants, said Tully Bascombe with a shrug. In this business, your bookkeeper can make you almost as much money as your bookmaker.
Understood, said Victor Fool. That's precisely why I asked to examine both set of books. More to the point, it's why I'm still not entirely convinced they're accurate. Are you certain you don't have a third set you're hiding from me?
If there's a third set, the captain hasn't told me anything about it, said Bascombe.
The casino manager stood comfortably at the foot of the desk where Fool was working, showing no signs of anxiety.
Not that it's any of my business, you understand, he continued. I make sure the floor is running smoothly and leave the rest up to the people the captain's put in charge. He wants my opinion, all he has to do is ask. But I'm not going to stick my nose into their business.
Victor Fool shuffled the hard copy pages, thinking. He knew better than to comment on Bascombe's unstated corollary, that a certain nose was being stuck into the captain's business and that it didn't belong there. Still, he made a mental note of the crack. Bascombe was, as far as he could tell, a thoroughly competent manager, but it was worth remembering that his loyalty lay with the younger Fool. That was all right with Victor Fool, as long as Bascombe was willing to do as good a job for the father as he'd done for the son, assuming, of course, that Bascombe had been doing a good job for the son. As long as he was sticking his nose into his son's business, Victor Fool intended to find that out as well. If he was going to stir up resentment, he might as well do a thorough job of it. He stood up from the desk and said to Bascombe,
"I can see already that the gambling operations are driving the entire business. It looks as if everything else you're doing is designed to attract customers to the casino floor to bet. So I want you to show me through the casino. Give me a satellite view of all that's involved in that end of the business."
"Okay," said Bascombe, without any great show of enthusiasm. "You want the tour right now?"
"Right now," said Victor Fool, his voice absolutely level.
It was time to show Bascombe who was boss. Fool hadn't built a galaxy-wide munitions business by being soft on his people. That appeared to be a lesson his son had failed to learn. Well, if the boy couldn't do a man's job, there was a man here ready to do it. He smiled coldly.
"Lead the way,"
he said, and fell in behind Bascombe as the casino boss led him out of the office. Behind Fool came his bodyguard, quiet and unobtrusive. Their first stop was a large room filled with video screens showing the casino from the viewpoint of the myriad cameras mounted above the floors. For every two or three screens, there was a casino employee intently peering at the scenes on display.
"This is the nerve center of the whole operation," said Bascombe. "Everything that goes on is recorded, so any funny business that goes on can be nipped in the bud. There's always somebody who thinks he can beat us at our own game. We don't mind the system, players. In the long run, no system can change the fact that the odds are rigged in the house's favor. If a few people win in the short run, that just encourages more people to try to beat us. And the bigger the handle, the bigger our profit."
"So what are you looking for?" asked Victor Fool. "You've got a lot of expensive equipment here,
and a lot of people sitting here watching it. What are they doing to earn their pay?
We're looking for two things, said Bascom. Professional cheaters can cost us, at least if they can get in and out before we catch them. We've got a database of known cheaters that we share with the other major betting houses, and we can spot most of the grifters before they even get to the betting tables, sometimes even before they set foot in the casinos. Watch this.
He touched a remote control, and a nearby monitor changed its display. Now it showed an elderly Asian woman pumping chips into a bank of quantum slots with the zombie effect of so many bored retired people.
Can you see what made us pick her out? Asked Bascom.
Victor Fool squinted at the display.
No, he said. Then, wait a minute. She's not using the same tokens as everybody else, is she? They're counterfeits.
Pretty good, said Bascom grudgingly. Maybe we could get you a job as a spotter. But here's the real catch. She's not just putting in counterfeit tokens. They're specially improved. Every one of them has a chip designed to increase her odds of winning one of the big jackpots. We might not have spotted it, except she got caught 5 years ago doing the same thing at the Horny Toad Casino. She changed her disguise, but we still got her once the computer matched up her appearance with her M.O. And a good thing, if we'd let her play a couple of hours, she was likely to walk out with 10 or 20,000. Now look at this one.
The grandmotherly type disappeared and was replaced by a middle-aged businessman in ostentatiously casual garb at the craps table. At the end of a play, the man scooped a pile of chips off the table and walked casually toward the cashier's booth.
"Do you see the hustle?" asked Bascom.
Victor Fool scratched his head.
"Run it again," he said, annoyed that he hadn't noticed anything out of the ordinary.
"Okay, keep your eyes open," said Bascom with a smirk.
Again the scene played out, perhaps 10 seconds long.
"I've got it," said Fool. "Right where he turns, and his hand goes in his pocket. I don't know what he's doing, but that's got to be when he does it."
Bascom laughed.
"Nah, he's just putting his hand in his pocket, maybe to check his hotel key. As far as we can tell, he wasn't doing anything this time."
Victor Fool glowered.
"So what's the point, then?"
Bascom toggled the remote, and the display changed to show the businessman and the Asian woman side by side.
"The point is, this is the same hustler you saw before. Different day, different disguise."
"That's hard to believe," said Fool, peering intently at the two faces. "They're so different."
"Right, and so are these," said Bascom,
toggling the remote to show a series of other faces. A flashily dressed young man, a weary-looking little fellow who might have been a file clerk, a statuesque black woman.
"And the damnedest part is, the hustler isn't even human," he added. "You see what we have to deal with?"
"I guess I do," said Victor Fool, shaking his head.
"What do you do when you catch it?"
"Put him on the first ship leaving the station and send the pick to the guards at the port of entry," said Bascom with a smile.
Now he'd shown the elder fool that he was in charge and that he belonged in charge.
"With any luck, you'll catch the hustlers before they even get into the casinos. That's one of the advantages of operating on a self-governing space station. You have a chance to keep the troublemakers out altogether, instead of having to catch them in the act."
"A good policy," said Fool, nodding. "The same idea works in the weapons business. You might be able to dodge missiles once they're launched, but it's a lot more effective to keep the other side from launching them to begin with."
"Makes sense to me," said Bascom. "The same idea is behind our employee screening program. We do an intensive background check on anybody applying for a job where they'll handle money. That prevents most of the potential problems. These monitors here are our best shot at catching the ones we can't interdict at the hiring stage. Every employee comes through this room as part of the orientation process, so they know their every move is being watched. That keeps most of them honest."
"And the rest?"
"The rest, we catch in the act," said Bascom. "And when we do, it's a one-way ticket off Lorelei forever."
"When?"
Victor Fool's voice had a skeptical edge to it.
"I think you mean if. You don't mean to say you catch all of them, do you?"
"You better believe we catch all of them," said Bascom stubbornly. "Nobody gets away with ripping off the fat chance."
"Overconfidence is your worst enemy," said Victor Fool. "If you think you're catching everything, you're bound to be overlooking something. Come on, admit it. You can't stop it all."
"We can, and we do,"
said Bascom, his jaw set even harder.
"You can't," said Victor Fool. "And I'm going to prove it."
"That I want to see," growled Bascom.
"Exactly how are you going to prove it?"
"If I tell you, You'll be looking for it, said Fool. Now excuse me. I think I'll go take a look at things from ground level. I have an idea exactly where you're going wrong, and I'm going to rub your nose in it. And when I do, I think my son will want to know just what kind of man he's put in charge of this casino.
He turned and walked away, his bodyguard a pace behind him.
He already knows what kind of man I am, Mr. Fool, muttered Bascombe. Too bad you don't know him well enough to trust his judgment.
He smiled, then turned to the casino employees watching the monitors.
Did you see that man who just left? I want you to watch him like a hawk every second he's on camera. Here's what I think he's going to try.
The Reverend Jordan Ayres was frustrated. For the first time in his career as a minister of the Church of the New Revelation, popularly known as the Church of the King, Rev had run into a problem he couldn't solve by consulting the sacred text and commentaries. Not even applying his good common sense, a commodity he believed himself to possess in ample measure, had he been able to get to the bottom of it. He tapped his fingers on his desk, staring at the useless computer readout, trying to decide what avenue to follow next. The problem was, there just wasn't enough known about the Zenobians. It had been only a few short years since the human race had encountered the reptilian Sophons, who in their appearance and habits resembled nothing so much as miniature allosaurs. That had been back on Haskins' planet, where Captain Jester's troops had intercepted one of their spaceships, an exploring party commanded by none other than Flight Lieutenant Qual. And to the best of Rev's knowledge, other than members of the Omega Company, no human being had set foot on the Zenobians' home world. Of course, the Alliance had done a fair amount of crash research into this new race when the Zenobians had requested formal membership, but much of that research remained unpublished, or at least inaccessible to someone with Rev's resources, which were far more comprehensive than those available to most civilians. In particular, nothing of the Zenobians' religious beliefs had been recorded by the diplomatic, military, and commercial interview teams that did the groundwork for the Alliance Treaty. It wasn't even known for certain that they had any such beliefs, except for the intriguing morsel that Flight Lieutenant Qual had offered in response to Rev's questions about the King. Laviz. Qual had claimed that Zenobian myth spoke of a figure with that name, a name that resonated curiously with that by which the King had gone in his earthly days. Even more intriguingly, Qual had remarked that, when Zenobians had first learned of the King, they had taken him as a human borrowing from their own mythology. Could the King have manifested himself on Zenobia, bringing his message to the reptilian Sophons of a world far distant from his own home? Rev knew he had to penetrate to the bottom of this mystery, one of the deepest he had found in all his years of reading the sacred text. Its implications for the Church were staggering, and its solution could catapult him to the first rank of its spokesman. But where to begin? Qual had implied that Zenobians were not comfortable speaking of such things to outsiders. That meant that Rev would need to take some sort of indirect approach. Did the little reptiles have sacred text he might access somehow? Their libraries must have the information he wanted, but so far they had not linked their data to the Alliance's interplanetary Uninet. Doubtless there were technicians who could make the connection unilaterally and find what Rev wanted. But where was he going to get a tech wizard with that level of expertise, and how was he going to pay him? Rev stood up from his desk. He paced over to his office window and stared out onto the Legion camp's parade ground, thinking. The King had always said that no problem was too difficult to tackle. If the highest mountain stood between him and his goal, he would just climb it. All Rev needed to do was put his mind to it. There had to be a way. There had to be a way. Zigger had never been aboard a spaceliner before. In fact, as far as he knew, nobody in his whole family had ever left their home world, not before he had decided to realize his ambition to join the Space Legion. The experience was considerably less dramatic than he had expected. For one thing, the spaceport had apparently been designed with the idea of giving travelers as forgettable an experience as possible. The furniture, the decor, the sights and sounds and smells, everything might as well have been designed to linger just below the threshold of annoyance, without ever breaking out into anything that evoked a specific response. And the ship itself? It might as well have been a crosstown hover bus, for all the passengers' awareness of being in deep space. Zigger found himself in one of a row of identical seats in the main cabin, unless he preferred to stay in his Spartan bunk in the dormitory-like sleeping area. The Space Legion, for all its attempts to woo its new recruits, had made it perfectly clear that it was not going to pay for anything more than the basic intersystem fare from the Leapoid's home world to the nearest Legion training camp. That meant a steerage class ticket with a very strict weight allowance for personal belongings. "Don't you worry about extra clothes," the recruiting sergeant had told him when he handed him the ticket. "You'll be wearing Legion black before long." Zigger would have liked to have at least a view screen in the cabin so he could watch the stars outside, even though he knew that hyperspace travel wildly distorted the appearance of everything outside the ship. Supposedly, there was a view screen in the first-class lounge. Zigger was tempted to sneak up and take a look for himself, but he couldn't figure out how to get past the heavy plasteel doors firmly protecting the people who mattered from curious Legion recruits and other such rabble. The population in steerage did seem to have a particularly high proportion of non-human sophons, Zigger thought. Well, where he was going, that would be different. Meanwhile, there was nothing else to do but sit in the main cabin and view his Poot-Poot brother's trivies. They were almost the only reminders of his youth that he hadn't been prepared to leave behind as he embarked on his new life. His broad jump medals, his talking ukulele, the lucky eider he'd found on the street the day he'd won the math contest, even the favorite winter hat he'd worn until his mother had to mend the ear holes 3 times, all were left behind. Even if he'd been sentimental about those artifacts, the exorbitant charges for overweight luggage would have changed his mind quickly enough. But the space line provided cheap tri-V viewers for its passengers and a reasonable library of current hits and all-time favorites, knowing full well that it offered little enough else to keep them from going slowly nuts in their long stretches between stars. And tri-Vs took up almost no weight or space. So Zigger's old friends, the Poot-Poot brothers, came along, and so did Uncle Poot-Poot and Mamselle Tony and all the other series regulars. Zigger was scrolling through one of the early episodes, Uncle Poot-Poot Meets Barky, when he became aware of someone looking over his shoulder. He turned around to see a human, a young one, he thought, although he wasn't familiar enough with the species to be entirely sure of his judgment.
"Hey, I hope I'm not bothering you," said the human. "It's just been a long time since I saw a Poot-Poot Trivy. That stuff's really sly. I loved it when I was a kid, especially that one with Barky, the environmental dog."
"I still like it," said Zigger. "Are you from Tulun?"
"No, I got on back at Fiano," said the human. "I'm on my way to Messina's world to join the Space Legion."
"No goofing," said Zigger. "That's where I'm bound as well. I guess we're going to be comrades in arms. What's your name?"
"Well, they say that Legionnaires don't tell anybody their real names," said the human. "They only go by their Legion names. The only problem is I haven't decided on mine yet. Have you got one picked out?"
"Sure," said Zigger. He'd been thinking about his Legion name ever since his first decision to enlist. He'd looked into several books about old Earth, hunting for something with just the right feeling. The answer, when he found it, seemed just right.
"You can call me Thumper," he said. "Thumper? That's pretty sly," said the human.
He wrinkled his brow, then confided,
"I've been thinking about calling myself Sharky. You think that fits?"
Zigger looked the human up and down, then nodded.
"It's you," he said,
not quite sure what made him say so. But it was obviously the right thing to say.
"All right," said Sharky. "Thumper, you and me gotta stick together. They say the Legion drill sergeants eat recruits for breakfast. Between the two of us, I bet we can keep each other one step ahead of the game. Is it a deal?"
"Sure," said Zigger. No, his name was Thumper now. Thumper grinned and said, "I've got a whole bunch of Poot-Poot Trivies. Come sit next to me and we can watch him while we figure out what we want to do now that we're Legion buddies."
"All right," said Sharky again. "Look out, sergeants. Here we come."
"Yo, Soosh, come here," said Doo-Wop, grinning evilly. "I got a swindle that can't lose."
"Right," said Sushi, raising an eyebrow.
He'd been listening to Doo-Wop's harebrained schemes ever since Captain Jester had made the two of them partners. Almost without exception, he'd ended up having to talk Doo-Wop out of his grandiose plans, most of which had some loophole big enough to drive a space liner through.
"What's the plan this time?"
"This one's as solid as neutronium," confided Doo-Wop. "You know how Chocolate Harry runs a big-ass poker game every time he wants some spare cash, which is like every couple 3 days?"
"Sure,"
said Sushi, leaning back on the fender of a cargo carrier. He folded his arms over his chest and looked Doo-Wop in the eye.
"Don't tell me you're going to try to cheat the Sarge at his own game. It'll never work."
"Nah, this is even sleaner," said Doo-Wop. "I'm going to get up my own game and swindle everybody else."
"Not very likely," said Sushi. "I know you. You lose every time you play poker with CH, and every other time I've ever seen you play. What makes you think it'll be any different just because you're the one running the game?"
"Because I've been watching the Sarge, and I finally figured out how he cheats," said Doo-Wop. "It's so evil. I don't know why I didn't think of it myself."
"Really?"
Sushi was impressed in spite of himself. If Doo-Wop had actually caught the supply sergeant cheating, He'd done something that had defied the best efforts of the entire company for as long as anyone remembered.
How does he do it?
Scope this out, said Duop.
He glanced around to make sure there were no eavesdroppers and lowered his voice. In a dramatic whisper, he said,
That fat old snorkeler drops out of a hand when he ain't got good cards.
What?
Sushi's voice rose nearly an octave, and his mouth fell open in surprise.
Shh! You want everybody to hear what it is? Said Duop, peering around worriedly. I tell you, it's a pure stroke of genius. Why, a dude could get rich overnight doing that.
Duop, that's not cheating, said Sushi. It's the way you're supposed to play poker.
Oh, sure, said Duop scornfully. Go try that one out on Tuscanini. It ain't gonna fly with me. If what you said was true, why don't everybody play that way?
Now there's a question well worth asking, said Sushi, grinning. In fact, I think I'm going to listen to myself and ask it. Why don't you play that way?
Duop's jaw dropped.
What? And missed the chance of winning a really big one? Believe me, Sush, there ain't no bigger rush than when everybody looks at your hand and thinks it's total crunk and tries to boost the betting so as to clean you out, and then your last hole card gives you that sure winner.
Right, said Sushi with a sigh. So how often does that happen?
All the time, man, said Duop excitedly. I had a hand like that just a couple of weeks ago. Had to draw six to make my straight on the last card. I hung in there and got the sucker on the last card.
Would have cleaned house, too, but all the dudes except Double X had folded before then, and I only won 7-8 bucks on it.
Uh-huh, said Sushi, unimpressed. And how many times do you play for that kind of hand and wind up with crunk anyhow?
Sometimes it happens, Duop admitted. But hey, like C8 says, you never go for it, you never get it.
Yeah, he would say that, said Sushi. You know, I'd be tempted to give you a lesson about poker odds, except I seem to remember that you got one of those from Tully Bascom back on Lorelei, and it obviously didn't take. Maybe he was right. It's a waste of time to wise up a sucker.
Hey, who you calling sucker? Said Duop. If you wasn't my buddy.
Whatever he was about to say, it was cut off by a fresh voice.
Good morning, boys. Would you all be interested in a little special project I just cooked up?
The two legionnaires turned to see Rev standing just behind them, with the half-sneer that was the closest he came to a smile.
Yo, Rev, what's up? Said Duop.
A little old electronic reconnaissance project, I think, would be the best thing to call it, said Rev. When I ran into this here problem, I couldn't help but think of you boys, remembering how you were the ones that cracked the nanoids' transmissions. How'd you like to do something along that line for me?
Sushi shrugged.
Depends on what you've got in mind, he said. Why don't you start talking, and we'll let you know whether it interests us.
Sure, sure, said Rev, glancing around the parade ground. But I'll tell you what. Why don't you all come into my office, where maybe it's a little more private? Then I can tell you the whole thing.
Lead the way, said Sushi. Come on, Duop. This might be fun.
What the hell. It's a slow day, said Duop.
The two legionnaires fell into line behind Rev and followed him to his office. At first, Sushi didn't know whether or not to make anything of the fact that Rev led them on a roundabout route instead of using the entrance nearest to his office, where Flight Lieutenant Qual and two of his fellow Zenobians were working on some of their electronic equipment. But when Rev began to describe his plan, Sushi understood.
All right, tell me about these games, said Victor Fool, standing in the middle of the Fat Chance Casino's main gambling floor. How do they work, and what does the house get from them?
Yes, sir,
chirped the young resort PR person Tully Bascom had assigned to show him around. Marty Mallard was blonde and perky, dressed in a short, tight skirt, the very image of a cheery bubblehead. Fool knew better than to take her at face value. He already had a look at the casino's personnel files and noticed that Ms. Mallard had graduated magna cum laude in interspecies studies from Liber Arts University, followed by a business degree from Taurus Tech. Underneath that perky exterior was a steel trap of a mind, and her presence on the Fat Chance Casino staff showed that his son's personnel department hadn't been completely asleep when it put her on the job.
The most popular attraction in almost all casinos is the slot machines, said Marty, leading Victor Fool into a large bay filled with customers happily pumping tokens into an array of quantum slots. One of the leading points of our ad campaign has been Captain Jester's decision to make the Fat Chance Casino slot machine payouts the highest on Landor.
I wish you wouldn't call my son that stupid Legion name, growled Victor Fool. What exactly is the payout percentage on these machines,
And why did my idiot son have to go raise it? That sounds like it had cut into profits.
Marty moved closer to Victor Fool and said in a low voice,
You probably don't want to talk about that in front of all these players, Mr. Fool. The fact is, even after your son shaved off 1% of the casino's percentage on the slots, it's still by far the most profitable of all the games we offer. No matter how big the jackpots are, on the whole, we're taking in a steady 20% of every dollar played.
Just then, a bell began ringing, accompanied by bright flashing lights and a honking klaxon.
Yes!
Shouted an enthusiastic voice, and along the ranks of avid quantum slot players, many, but far from all heads, turned to see what had set off the noise, which now included an electronically amplified victory march.
There's one now, said Marty. The bells and lights mean it's at least $1,000. We want to make sure everybody knows when there's a big winner.
Victor Fool was incredulous.
You're giving away $1,000?
Of course, said Marty.
She managed somehow to whisper out of the corner of her mouth without losing her bright smile.
The players have to believe that they have a chance to win, and win big, if they're going to come here instead of one of the other casinos. On any given play, a player has a chance to win a jackpot of $100, $1,000, even $10,000. And when one of them does hit a jackpot, we give them the bells and lights so nobody can forget they have that chance.
Victor Fool's expression was skeptical.
To tell you the truth, I've never understood why anybody would bet on anything but a sure winner, he said. And when you're giving somebody a chance to take away $1,000 or more if what you say is right, then the casino is betting on a losing proposition. On top of that, we give them free drinks and free food and entertainment at a bargain price as well. Why aren't we charging a competitive price for that when we're giving away money hand over fist in the casinos?
Marty's voice dropped even lower.
Because for every big jackpot, there are hundreds of losing bets, and that's the foundation of the business. Every single day of the year, as inevitable as taxes, the casino takes in many times what even the luckiest player can expect to win. Over the long run, the casino comes out solidly in the black.
Solidly in the black is all right, said Victor Fool. But I got my MBA at Rake It In School of Business, and they taught us that any businessman worth his salt aims to maximize profits. I've built my arms business into the biggest in the galaxy by following that principle, and I can't see why it doesn't apply to this so-called business as well.
You saw the books, Mr. Fool,
said Marty, shrugging. Even now, the smile never left her face.
If you don't want to believe what you saw, there's not much I can do to change your mind. The odds are stacked in the house's favor and always will be.
Fool frowned.
There's a loophole somewhere, he said. If the odds are so heavily stacked, none of these people would keep coming back to play. Yet I've already heard several of them say they're back for a fourth or fifth visit. There are obviously some consistent winners. That's what worries me. If one person can keep winning, then others can, and if enough learn how, they can put this place out of business.
Marty shook her head.
It doesn't work that way, Mr. Fool, she said patiently. There's no way around the odds. In the long run...
Long run? Phew, said Victor Fool. Your whole business principle is wrong, and I'm going to prove it. Where do I get tokens to play these machines?
Right over there, Mr. Fool,
said Marty, pointing. She smiled quietly. It wasn't the first time somebody had refused to believe the simple facts, nor would it be the last. Every casino in the galaxy made its money because of people who didn't believe in the odds. It looked as if Victor Fool was about to find that out the hard way. Chapter 4 Journal Number 664
Excessive displays of zeal should always be grounds for suspicion. The religious bigot, the super-patriot, and the zealous company man have in common an emotion, loyalty to something larger than their individual interest. Loyalty to the greater cause is an emotion that everyone shares to some degree, and that in due proportion ought to be considered a good thing. But the zealots carry it to such an extreme that any reasonable person would feel a degree of embarrassment. Even more than the fanatical fixity of their loyalties is the lack of a sense of proportion that makes them suspect. Anyone with a balanced view of the world around him inevitably becomes, to some degree, a cynic. I consider myself to have an exceptionally well-balanced view of the world around me. In consequence, I am frequently annoyed by the impositions of those less balanced persons I find myself surrounded by.
The shuttle settled down roughly a kilometer south of the Legion camp. Fool and Beaker watched the landing from within the camp perimeter. Then, as the cloud of dust began to settle, Fool gave a signal to his driver, Gears. The hover jeep moved forward toward the landing site. Ahead of them, the shuttle door was already open, and two men, presumably the hunters, were standing idly by, watching the crew piling luggage and equipment on a crawler. They'd evidently brought enough to last them twice as long as their little expedition was scheduled for. Either that, or they'd assumed there wouldn't be laundry facilities at a Legion camp. Actually, thought Fool, fastidious visitors might have been advised not to trust their clothing to the mercies of a Legion field laundry, as much to avoid the likelihood of rough handling as on account of pilferage. With its own state-of-the-art automatic laundry facility built into the encampment module, Omega Company was miles ahead of the normal Legion standard, but the visitors would be excused for not having known that in advance. Gears brought the hover jeep to a halt next to the equipment crawler, and Fool leapt lightly to the ground. "Good afternoon, gentlemen," he said, holding out his hand. "I'm your host, Captain Jester. Welcome to Zenobia." The men had been staring at Jester during the hover jeep's approach. Now one of them took the captain's offered hand and shook it.
"Our host, eh?" he said. "Not quite the way most people describe a visit from us. But I'm glad you're taking it in good spirits, Captain. It'll make our work here a lot easier."
Fool chuckled. "Work isn't exactly how I'd describe your visit either," he said heartily. "We've convinced the Zenobians to open up an area where no off-worlder has ever been. I'd call it virgin territory, gentlemen. It won't be exactly a weekend in the Waldorf, but I think you'll find it worth the effort. They tell me there are some spectacular beasts in there."
"Opened up virgin territory?"
It was a woman's voice that replied, and Fool turned automatically to face the speaker. She was tall, with sharp features under a bowl haircut, and was dressed in the same dull-colored jumpsuit as the men, Fool now realized. The name tag on her breast read C.I. Sneef.
"I certainly hope that's an exaggeration, Captain," she added, pursing her lips. "We want to keep this planet's indigenous territory unspoiled, wherever possible. Your company's presence is enough of a problem."
Fool wrinkled his brow, slowly beginning to realize that there was something going on he didn't quite follow.
"Excuse me," he began.
Before he could finish the thought, a new creature emerged from the shuttle hatchway and made a beeline for the Legion hover jeep, uttering a steady stream of angry barks.
"What the hell?"
said Gears, jumping back into the jeep to escape the agitated animal.
"Hey there, big fellow,"
said Fool, going down on one knee and stretching out a hand to the dog.
"What's your name, huh?"
The dog, ignoring him, circled the hover jeep, staring balefully at Gears and snarling.
"Surely you recognize Barky, the famous environmental dog?"
said Sneef.
"He's been on Trivi all over the galaxy. Every school child loves to watch him sniff out pollution and other dangers to the natural balance. Your hover jeep's emissions must not be properly controlled."
"I beg your pardon, ma'am,"
said Gears, who had climbed up on the seat to avoid the attentions of Barky.
"I set this vehicle up myself, and if it ain't totally up to spec, I'll eat it one piece at a time, without no ketchup, neither. Hey, can you call your dog off?"
he added, with a note of concern.
"Barky is never wrong about pollution,"
said Sneef. She turned to one of her companions and said,
"Inspector Slurry, please impound that vehicle until we can have it properly tested."
"Woof,"
said Barky, the environmental dog, his front paws up on the running board of the hover jeep. It was not a friendly woof. Gears cringed.
"Wait a minute,"
said Fool, interposing himself between Sneef's two assistants and the hover jeep. "That's a Legion vehicle. You can't impound that."
"We certainly can,"
said Sneef haughtily.
"Inspector Gardner, show him the subpoena."
The third member of the team, a tall, thin man with long reddish-blonde hair and a goatee, grinned and handed Fool a folded envelope. On one side it was marked, "Recycled Paper." Fool turned it over to read the other side. "Alliance Ecological Interplanetary Observation Union. Inspection order and subpoena."
"Subpoena?"
asked Fool, blinking.
"Inspection?"
"Sir, I believe I understand the situation," said Beaker. "This is obviously not the party of, visitors we were expecting. This is an environmental inspection team from the Alliance Ecological Interplanetary Observation Union, and I'm afraid, sir, that they are perfectly within their rights to impound any vehicle suspected of improper emissions. The laws are quite explicit on that subject, sir."
"Alliance Ecological Interplanetary Observation Union?"
Fool stared at the three inspectors, a puzzled look on his face.
"But we shouldn't be under their jurisdiction. This planet has its own sovereign government."
"That may be so, Captain,"
said Sneef.
"But we certainly aren't about to take your word for it. All the preliminary reports indicate that we might just be in time to prevent an environmental disaster, and nothing I've seen so far suggests anything to the contrary, beginning with your driving a vehicle out to our landing site. Are you Legionnaires so lazy that you can't use your own feet? Have you forgotten how to march?"
What?
Sputtered Fool.
I don't understand.
"Sir, I think we'd best get out of the inspector's way and let them do their work,"
said Beaker. And next time you receive an environmental impact questionnaire, I suggest you give it to someone other than Toscanini to fill out.
Fool nodded, understanding at last.
In that case, I think we'd best head back to camp, Inspector Sneef.
Chief Inspector Sneef, thank you, said the woman.
Yes, of course, Chief Inspector, said Fool. If there's anything you need from my people, please let me know. We'll be happy to cooperate.
I certainly hope so, said Chief Inspector Sneef. The law provides very hefty penalties for obstruction of environmental inspection.
We don't have anything to hide, said Fool. You'll see when you arrive at our guest quarters.
Oh, no,
said Snife.
Regulations prohibit us from accepting accommodations with a suspected violator. We'll be setting up our own camp, Captain. I think you'll find it an instructive example of a minimal impact inhabitation. Now, if you'll excuse us, we have to finish unloading.
Of course, said Fool.
Excuse me, ma'am, came Gears's voice. If you'll just, call off your dog.
Sneef ignored him as she plastered a bright orange sticker to the door of the hover jeep. It said in block letters, impounded for pollution.
Woof,
said Barky, the environmental dog.
Woof, 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 woof.
Legion Boot Camp was nothing Thumper, as Zigger now called himself, had ever seen before. For one thing, the population was predominantly made up of humans, although there were enough members of other species to keep him from feeling completely outnumbered. He was the only Lepoid on the base, though. At least, the only one he'd seen in his bewilderingly rapid trip through the initial processing area. That had been an experience he'd just as soon forget. Luckily, it had gone quickly enough that it seemed to be over almost before it started, but not before he'd been poked and prodded by doctors and the autodoc had jammed his arm with at least a dozen inoculations for diseases the Legion thought his race might be susceptible to on distant planets. The doctors had spent a good half hour looking him up on the base's medical expert system before deciding which inoculations he was likely to need and which were likely to be more danger than help. He'd still been woozy most of the next day. Maybe a reaction to the shots. Maybe something else. All the humans were given ultra-short regulation haircuts. Being of a short-furred species, Thumper was spared that indignity at least. But he was issued a Black Legion jumpsuit at least three sizes too large, and combat boots that no imaginable breaking in would ever make comfortable for his elongated feet. He was all ready to protest this treatment, but he realized that none of the other new recruits' uniforms were the right size either. Half an hour of searching and trading found him a jumpsuit that fit him better, and his was the almost right size for another recruit, a lanky, bespectacled human who had adopted the Legion name Spider. No one in the outfit had a pair of boots that fit Thumper. Since appearing without boots was defined as being out of uniform, a serious offense against Legion discipline, that was going to be a problem. But Thumper had plenty of other problems to distract him from the boots. Prime among these was his drill instructor, Sergeant Pitbull, who seemed to be of primarily human origin, although there were whispers that he was at least part something else. Exactly what that something else might be, none of the recruits was willing to say, at least not where the sergeant might hear it, which was apparently everywhere in the barracks. At least, the sergeant had an uncanny ability to storm into a room immediately after one of the recruits had said something mildly critical of Legion discipline, and to chew out the offender in terms none of them had dreamed of before they had joined the Legion. It was on their third night of training that Thumper and his new comrades simultaneously realized that the Legion recruiters had actually told them the truth about one thing. Legion boot camp wasn't going to be easy.
By St. Elrod and all powers, I never knew there were so many places I could hurt, said Sharky, lying flat on his bunk just after lights out.
That ain't nothing, said Spider. I never knew there were so many different wrong ways to wear a uniform. Seems like I just can't do it right, nohow.
Thumper nodded. Even having found a uniform that fit properly, he was still having trouble getting it to look right, or so the sergeant seemed to think.
I guess they want us to pay attention to all the details, he said. When you're in a hostile environment, one little detail could make the difference.
Oh, bull, said Spider. Tell me what difference it gonna make how I fasten my sleeve button.
Well, that's not what I mean, said Thumper. The point is, they want to train us so we don't overlook anything. Then, when you're in a combat situation, you're less likely to overlook something that could kill you.
Ain't nobody ever been killed by a sleeve button that I heard of,
insisted Spider. Thumper was about to try his explanation again when somebody hissed,
Pitbull!
And the entire bunkroom fell silent in fear of the sergeant's wrath. For once, the sergeant didn't materialize,
but by the time the recruits realized it was a false alarm, half of them were asleep, and nobody else seemed inclined to take up the thread. The one part of Legion life that Thumper found congenial was the healthy dose of physical activity. Drill, exercise, hard labor, and more drill. Perhaps this was because he had come to the Legion not as a last chance to escape from an intolerable existence back home, but as an actual lifelong goal. Running, marching, and doing endless calisthenics shouldn't bother someone who had kept himself in good physical condition, he kept telling his buddies. Most of the time, they were too exhausted to answer him, but the looks they shot in his direction were eloquent, had he only been able to read them. At last, even his friend Sharky, whom he'd met on the space liner that brought them to Legion boot camp, warned him that he was getting too gung-ho. They'd ended up in the same recruit platoon by the simple expedient of showing up at the processing center at the same time.
"What's wrong with being gung-ho?" asked Thumper.
"You're making the other guys look bad," said Sharky. "We're all in this together, you know. It ain't good if you show up your buddies."
"I'm not trying to show anybody up," Thumper protested.
"I've always wanted to be a Legionnaire. Now that I am one, why shouldn't I try to be a good one?"
"'Cause you make things harder for the rest of us," Sharky explained. "If most of us want to punk out after 100 push-ups and you keep going, the sergeant's going to get on our asses to keep up with you."
"Gee, I never thought of that," said Thumper.
"But don't you want to be all you can be? If you do more push-ups, you'll get stronger. That could be important when the crunch comes."
"Crunch? What crunch?"
Sharky scoffed.
"The Alliance hasn't been in a real war since my grandpa was a kid."
"No? But that doesn't mean it won't happen."
"Against who?" Sharky demanded. "Every time we meet a new race, they want to join up with us on account of the trade advantages, like those lizards out on Zenobia."
Thumper shook his head.
"There was a civil war on Landor."
"Sure, and that wasn't much more than a food fight from what I hear tell," said Sharky. "Nobody except the locals got hurt. All the Legion did was go in to mop up, and they spent more time lying on the beach than anything else. So why make things any tougher than you have to?"
"You can't assume just because things have been easy lately that it's always going to be like that," insisted Thumper.
"Hey, I'm just trying to give you a clue," said Sharky. "If you play along with the other guys, everybody's happy. Make too many waves, nobody's going to be happy, and they're going to know whose fault it is."
"All right, I understand you," said Thumper with a nod and a smile.
He didn't say what he was thinking. He didn't have to. His actions would do the talking for him when the time came.
"The slots, huh?" Tully Bascom shook his head in disbelief at what the security monitors were showing. "Most of the guys who think they can beat the house by playing some kind of homemade system go for blackjack," he said, "or poker if they think they can win steady enough to cover the house percentage."
Doc grinned. "That's for sure. Only suckers play the quantum slots. They're the worst bet in the joint. You showed us that, back when the captain first brought us to Lorelei."
"Yep," said Bascom.
"I guess the captain didn't tell his old man that, though. Look at him pumping the tokens into those machines."
"Yeah, I saw him pretty near knock down two white-haired little old ladies who tried to horn in on a machine he'd been priming," said Doc. "He's got the fever, all right."
"Well, he's a grown man," said Bascom. "And I guess he can afford to lose a few bucks. Hell, I doubt we could put a serious dent in his bankroll if we set up a row of $1,000-a-pull machines. That doesn't mean I'm not tempted, though."
"Nah, what's the point? At that price, nobody but Victor Fool could ever afford to play him," said Doc.
"And what would the payouts have to be?"
"High enough to make a billionaire's palm sweaty," said Bascom. "Right now, I think he's just playing on principle. He thinks the payouts are too generous, and he's trying to prove the point. To really get him hooked, we need to offer something big. Even $1 million is probably small potatoes, when you're talking about someone who's used to supplying armaments to entire planets."
Doc rubbed his chin and leaned forward to point at Victor Fool's image on the security monitor.
"What if we set up a bank of machines for nobody but Pop Fool to play? Offer him a jackpot that'll make even his mouth water. Title to the whole Don Casino, for example. But at impossibly long odds. Once he's thrown enough tokens down the slot, then he'll have to admit that we aren't giving away money."
"You've got an evil mind," said Bascom, chuckling. "Only one problem I can see with it. We don't own the casino. Omega Company does. And we can't offer a prize we aren't able to deliver if somebody does win it. Not even on Lorelei, where the house rules and the laws of the land are pretty damn close to one and the same."
"So we make the odds so impossible that he can't possibly win is all," Doc insisted.
Let's say he's got to get 5 simultaneous jackpots on 5 different machines, or some other combination that only comes up once in a trillion times.
Bascom shook his head.
It's tempting, you know, Doc, but we can't do anything as screwy as that without getting the captain to sign off on it. I don't care if we would be setting those crooked slots to teach his father a lesson. Bad business is bad business, even when you keep it in the family.
I guess you're right, said Doc. In fact, has anybody gotten in touch with Captain Jester? He'd want us to tell him that his father's here. I'm pretty sure of that.
I got his okay before showing the old man the books, said Bascom, snapping his fingers. But this is a new wrinkle, and I'm not sure whether he'd go along with it. Guess the only thing to do is to get him on the horn and ask.
Right, said Doc. He pressed one of the studs on his wrist chronometer and nodded.
It's mid-afternoon at Zenobia Base, so he's likely to be in reach of a vid phone. Do you want to call him, or shall I? Or shall we just send a priority message and let him get back to us?
Seeing that it's during his business hours, I think we better tell him this in person, said Bascom. And since I'm in charge of the gambling end of the business, I guess I ought to be the one to make the call. You want to talk to him, too? He might have a few questions you can answer as well as I can.
Sure, why not? Said Doc.
He waved a hand in the direction of the monitor.
One good thing. Our main problem's not going anywhere, except maybe to the cashier's window for another batch of tokens.
Let's hope he makes that particular trip a lot of times, said Bascom with a thin smile.
He gestured toward a door, and the two men went to the office to place a call to Captain Jester.
"You forking slugs disgust me!"
roared a voice that seemed far too loud for an ordinary human's vocal apparatus. Thumper jerked his eyes open, awaking from the utterly exhausted sleep he'd been in a fraction of a second before. He automatically checked the time. 5 a.m. The drill instructor, Sergeant Pitbull, was right on time, fully dressed and ready to eat raw recruits for breakfast. Thumper had last seen him only 6 hours before, when he'd put the squad of new legionnaires to bed with threats and curses. Thumper still hadn't figured out how the drill instructor managed to stay alert and fit on what must be even less rest than the recruits were getting, but he'd come to take it for granted. Every task he demanded of the recruits, including some that at first had seemed impossible, Sergeant Pitbull could perform better than any of them, despite being at least 10 years older. Even Thumper, who had already learned that he was in better physical condition than most all of his fellow recruits, couldn't beat the sergeant in any direct competition, especially in hand-to-hand combat, where the sergeant seemed to have a bottomless repertory of dirty tricks. Even in an outright sprint, where Thumper was sure he had the advantage, Sergeant Pitbull had somehow managed to make him trip and fall before he got 3 steps from the start. Worst of all, it seemed as if the sergeant was always angry. One night, after lights out, the whispered conversation in the bunkhouse got to the subject of whether anyone could remember hearing a friendly remark pass Pitbull's lips. The closest anyone could come was,
"That's right, way to stomp his worthless civvy ass,"
when a hulking recruit named Crunch put Spider in the infirmary with a dislocated shoulder during judo practice. And while Crunch was probably right that the sergeant meant it as a compliment on his judo technique, most of the other recruits agreed with Spider's heated protestation that congratulating one of the recruits for injuring another wasn't his idea of a friendly word. Then Sergeant Pitbull slammed the door open and bellowed,
"Shut up, you stinking bugs!"
He seemed never to have learned to speak softly. In the utter silence that followed this remark, he continued,
"When I turn the lights out, you're supposed to fark in sleep, not yammer like a bunch of schoolgirls. There'll be punishment detail for the whole farkin' squad."
After that, even Crunch conceded the point. Pitbull had been as good as his word. Next morning, there were 100 extra push-ups for everyone. But this was another morning, which meant another chance for Pitbull to deal out arbitrary punishment. Thumper and all his buddies scrambled out of their bunks and came to attention. There was just a glimmer of a chance that today they might manage to avoid extra push-ups or some other equally unpleasant task. Not much of a chance, but Thumper had gotten in the habit of grasping at even minuscule chances. Along the way, he'd gotten much better at push-ups than he'd ever imagined being. It wasn't what he'd seen himself doing when he dreamed of joining the Legion, but if his experience so far was any indication, push-ups were a significant component of Legion life.
"Listen up, you filthy skime-eaters!"
roared Sergeant Pitbull. Thumper wasn't sure what a skime was, but after hearing the sergeant, he knew he didn't want to eat one. Or maybe it was a filthy one he didn't want to eat, He had only a brief moment to meditate on that question, as the sergeant continued with his high-volume harangue.
"Today, we're going out to the obstacle course," the sergeant boomed. "That's where we separate the real legionnaires from the farking, weak-sibling civvies. Do you bugs want to be real legionnaires?"
"Yes, Sergeant Pitbull,"
the squad shouted in chorus. They'd long since learned that any less enthusiastic response would be greeted with scorn. Privately, Thumper wondered whether Sergeant Pitbull might have stood too close to an explosion at some point in his earlier career, damaging his ears in the process. If he were partly deaf, that would explain a lot. But no, the auto docs could fix that.
"Follow me, you bugs,"
said the sergeant, and he set off at a flat-out run, the only speed at which a Legion recruit was allowed to move. Luckily for Thumper, he could outrun everyone in the squad without particularly trying. It was one of the minor advantages of being a Lepoid. He hadn't found very many of them here in the Legion, so he'd acquired a finer appreciation for the ones he'd found. Running easily, he stayed just behind the sergeant until the squad arrived, many of them huffing and puffing despite several weeks of rigorous exercise at the obstacle course. In front of him, Thumper saw a tract of land that would probably feel flattered to be described as ruined, or even devastated. It was a mud-filled morass with craters and chunks of broken stone wall, or the jagged stumps of trees at seemingly random intervals. The few open stretches were strewn with skeins of ugly-looking barbed wire laid parallel to the ground. Here and there were wide water-filled ditches and 8-foot wooden walls. At the far side, Thumper could make out sandbagged bunkers from which the muzzles of machine guns protruded.
"Listen up, you bugs," explained Sergeant Pitbull. "This here's what we call a stimulated battlefield, which if you're ever in a farking shooting war, you're going to see a shitload of 'em. The drill is, when I blow my whistle, you get to the other side as fast as you farking can. But check this out. Them sky meters with the machine guns going to shoot live farking ammo over your heads, so you better keep 'em the hell down. We lose a couple three stupid-ass recruits every month on account of they jumped up and tried to run away."
Thumper nodded as the sergeant explained the drill. Looking at the course, he could see that the machine guns were limited to a narrow field of fire. Outside that area, the main problem was dodging around the craters and rubble. But if one didn't mind a bit of mud, there was no reason to go at less than full speed. After all, the sergeant had said that the point of the exercise was to get to the other side as quickly as possible. So when the sergeant blew his whistle, Thumper was off and running. Fool stared blankly at the sheaf of papers that had just landed on his desk.
"What's all this?"
he asked in an annoyed voice. It was obviously not the promotion papers he'd been expecting from Legion headquarters.
"Environmental impact form from those AEIOU guys,"
said Roadkill, one of the two Legionnaires who'd carried in the mountain of paperwork.
"That Chief Inspector Sneef brought it over in some kind of wheelbarrow. Street and I just happened to be the first Legionnaire she saw, and she took that as a license to order us around."
"Order you around?" Lieutenant Armstrong looked up from the adjacent desk where he was filling out work assignment forms.
"I think I'm going to have to talk to her myself. I've been trying to get some of you rascals to follow orders ever since I became an officer in this outfit, with little or no sign that I'm getting anywhere."
"Jeez! Some thanks we get for being good Legionnaires,"
grumbled Street. "I'd have given her a piece of my mind if she hadn't had that stupid dog with her. That ugly mutt looked at me as if it was going to take a bite out of my tail end."
"Barky, the environmental dog?"
asked Fool. "He seemed pretty harmless to me."
"I think he thought Street was a polluter," said Roadkill, deadpan. "Or maybe a litterer. It's hard to tell what that dog thinks when all say is woof."
"Stupid mutt can't prove nothing on me,"
said Street, scowling.
"Are you saying that because you haven't done anything, or because you think you've covered up your tracks?"
said Armstrong, raising one eyebrow just a fraction. He pointed at the two Legionnaires and added,
"Don't be too sure Barky can't sniff you out, if you've been polluting."
"I already told you, I ain't done nothing,"
said Street. He stared at the floor, squirming, as if one of his school teachers had called on him to recite a lesson he hadn't studied.
"It's all right, Street. Nobody suspects you of anything,"
said Fool. Then, remembering to whom he was speaking, he hastily added,
"Not this time, anyway."
"Yeah, I was just joking,"
said Roadkill, punching his buddy on the biceps.
"But we'd better get back to that job we were doing before somebody notices we're gone. Then we might really get in trouble."
"Just tell them you were bringing me something,"
said Fool.
"And thanks.
I think.
He looked at the pile of papers, and his expression was anything but thankful.
But Roadkill and Street were already out the door.
Fool picked up the top sheet of one of the piles of papers and began to read it, but before he